Okay, this is CS50. Welcome to everyone to Harvard University and to CS50's annual educator workshop. My name is David Malin, and I teach the course here at Harvard along with all of my colleagues, two of whom I'd like to introduce first, Aaron and Greg, if you'd like to come say hello.
Hi, everyone. I've likely exchanged emails with all of you. I'm the one who's been clogging your inbox. But so happy to finally meet all of you today and hope you guys have a great weekend.
Yeah, welcome everybody. I think we're gonna have a great couple of days. I'm excited about it. And I'll do a more formal introduction in just a little bit whenever I get to my section, but I'm so glad to meet you all and look forward to what we have in store.
Indeed, thank you. So CS50, as you may have known or gleaned from our various initiatives online, is as much about community as it is about computer science. So among our goals this weekend is not only to introduce you to or recap the course's pedagogy and the various curricular options, but also, frankly, just to bring everyone in this room and some more people tomorrow together so that you feel when you do leave Cambridge, you have a whole network of folks, teachers and students alike, with whom you can reach out for support and with whom you can connect in the many months, if not years, to come. But we thought we'd begin with a look at CS50 itself and to sort of tee things up a different spoiler. So we thought we'd give you a glimpse of precisely that culture that we hope so characterizes CS50. Here on campus, of course, we have a number of traditions with which you might be familiar, not only teaching the class itself, but starting the semester with what we call CS50 Puzzle Day, the design of which is to send a message that computer science is as much about, is ultimately about problem solving and the collaboration with others on solving those problems. Toward the end of the semester, do we have our CS50 Hackathon, the goal of which from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. is to create one of those memorable scholastic meetings that is ultimately academic in nature but social in experience, where students work on their final projects or whatever it is they have at hand at that moment. And then, of course, the climax of the semester is the CS50 Fair, an exhibition course-wide of students' final projects that we would encourage you, too, in your own schools to do to bring together students and faculty and staff from well beyond your class and really get students excited about what they've accomplished that semester, but also the next year. We, of course, have a tradition of bringing quite a few cameras to the places we teach, including all of these events, and thought we'd give you a glimpse of what we do here in Cambridge. And then along the way, we'll share some photographs from some of our teachers and students from around the world to paint a picture, too, of the communities that have arisen. And now, this is CS50.
What about us? We are searchlights we can see in the dark. We are pointed up at the stars. We are billions of beautiful hearts, and you sold us down the river too far.
So all of that footage is thanks to CS50's production team and Emily Yu in particular, who put together that music and the footage ultimately for that film. So we thought we'd begin kind of where we begin the semester itself on campus, but rather than teach the material that you've yourself already gleaned over years of experience, we thought we'd try to do things a little more meta, where we explain some of the things that we do right from the start of the semester and then transition to a very quick rapid-fire overview of the course's curriculum and ultimately end with a look at what we hope to accomplish with everyone this week. weekend. And by all means, interject at any point if you have any questions. So I myself always begin the semester by pointing out to students that I wasn't really a computer science-minded kid when I was in high school. And indeed, I completely shied away from the very small computer lab with the little glass window with all those lines in the window, looking in at my friends who had their heads down at the PCs that were in the room and just kind of tapping away, not really talking. And it just wasn't a world that at all appealed to me. And I think that was fundamentally because I didn't really know what it was. And I also didn't quite appreciate that it's computer science isn't ultimately about programming. Indeed, that's just a tool that computer scientists might use to solve problems, but it really is about problem solving. Well, what does problem solving mean more concretely than that abstract term? You know, I dare say we could distill it as this. Problem solving is the process of taking inputs and producing outputs, and that input is the problem we want to solve. The output is hopefully the solution there too, and then the sort of secret sauce in the middle is what we might call algorithms, but we'll come back to that in just a moment. But if you have inputs and outputs, you need to represent those somehow, because a computer is a physical device, and so you need to somehow consider how you can store inputs and store or represent outputs. And so we very quickly at the start of our semester typically begin with just the obvious. So this, of course, looks like what? What number is this? 123. So no trick question. This is just literally the number 123. But all of us probably just did kind of a quick mental hurdle applying some lessons learned from grade school or whatnot when we thought about what this really means. Because arguably, this isn't necessarily the number 123. It's just three symbols on the screen. It's three things that someone has painted or drawn on the screen to which we have begun to ascribe meaning. And at least the way I learned how to ascribe meaning to just the symbology was back in the day, if I see the number 1 or the pattern 123, it has sort of a mathematical meaning because this is the so-called ones place or ones column, and this is the so-called tens place and the hundreds place, and if the number were bigger, we could keep going to thousands and ten thousands and the like. So this number, this pattern 123, is really the number we humans all appreciate as 123 because this, of course, is like 100 times 1, and this is, of course, 10 times 2, and this is, of course, 1 times 3. And if we add these all together, that's 100 plus 20 plus 3, and albeit sort of a circular argument, we're back at that same pattern. That's why these symbols have meaning. And it's the so-called decimal system, dec meaning 10, because in our human world we tend to use 0 through 9, which is 10 total digits. But of course, computers, we probably all know, don't really, they can support decimal, but at the end of the day, we've all generally heard that they speak what language instead, really? Yeah, binary. Bi meaning 2, and what that translates into is just 2 digits. And they happen to be by convention 0 and 1, but you could call them true or false or red or blue or black and white. You just need 2 terms to describe them. But this is convenient because at the end of the day, my computer and your computer and our phones these days are electronic devices, and the only way they sort of refuel each day is by way of a little cord like this. And even if you're not an electrical engineer or recall how it all works, you know, generally you probably recall that there's electrons that are kind of flowing one way or the other, and that's the physical resource that's recharging or powering devices like this. But the interesting thing about electricity or lighting in a room like this is that really it's kind of either on or it's off. The electrons are flowing or they're not flowing. And so this room right now, all the lights are on, might be said to represent the number 1 or true because it's on. But if I go over here and hit all off, okay, except for the video lights we have now, this is sort of like a 0.5 value, I guess. But this is really arguably a 0. Like the power is off, and so we're just saying that the electricity is off, and so our state is now 0. And we could toggle back and forth to represent 0, 1, 0, 1, and so forth. So that's useful because that means physically we have the ability to do either one thing or the other. And we could just arbitrarily but consistently call those zeros or ones. And so what does this really mean? Well, it turns out if we have the binary system, the number system is really kind of fundamentally the same. It's just some of the implementation details are a tad different. Instead of having 1, 10, and 100 as our columns, we instead have not powers of 10, but powers of 2. 1, the 2's column, and the 4's column. So it's 2 to the 0, 2 to the 1, 2 to the 2, and so forth, instead of 10 to the 0, 10 to the 1, 10 to the 2, and so forth. And so if now a computer wanted to represent the number that we humans know as 0, what pattern of bits, or as it turns out, binary digits, bits, do we use? What pattern of zeros and ones? yeah, 000, right? Because I need 04s and I need 02s and I need 01s. Ergo, this is how a computer would represent the number 0. If the computer wanted to represent the number we humans know as 1, what do I need to change here? Yeah, so this this becomes just 001. And now it's an opportunity to ask the class something that might be a little bit non-obvious. How do I want to represent the number 2?
Turn on the 2 switch and off the 1.
Yeah, and we have to remember to now switch off the 1 because we don't want to represent the number 3. We want to represent the number 2. And herein lies the difference. And one of the ways we introduce this topic sometimes is to not even start at decimal and binary. We sometimes just start at unary. Unary, implying 1, where you just kind of use hash marks or your fingers. Right? The interesting question you could ask in a class here might be, well, how high can I count with just my one hand? You know, a traditional answer would be probably 5. So this is 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But I could encode these values differently. Right now, unary means I have just one symbol, a finger, or nothing at all. There's not a second symbol I could really use on my hand. But I could count higher than 5. How high could I actually count on one hand if I'm super clever? So 31, yeah, there are 32 possible values. But if I start at 0, now where does that derive from? Well, this could still be 1. And this in unary would be 2. But if I'm using binary, as Felix is proposing, this is really 2. 3 now becomes this. And then the joke here is always 4 always becomes a little offensive. And then 5 becomes this. Two fingers up. And then we can do 6 and 7. And we can, I probably physically can't count all the way up to 15. But theoretically, I actually could. So a possible tangent there. But if we keep the focus only on the mapping of our decimal system to our binary system, the system is fundamentally the same. So if a student knows, generally speaking, that computers somehow only understand zeros and ones, well, that derives from the very understanding that they themselves have from grade school. If we count up now to 3, this is going to go up to 0, 1, 1. If we want to count up to 4, the whole thing changes to 1, 0, 0. If we want to count up to 5, this becomes 5. If we want to count up to 6, this becomes 6. And if we want to count up to 7, we count up to 7. And of course, if we want to count up to 8, what needs to happen? Yeah, we need another digit. So we have to sort of literally carry the 1, even though we can only count as high as 1. But we also need another bit. And this affords us an opportunity to really talk about what these bits, these binary digits, really translate into in the real world. And if I actually consider a light source that isn't as dramatic as the whole room here, this could represent a bit. My little phone here has a tiny little flashlight built in. And arguably, right now, my phone represents a 0. But if I hit the button and turn on the little flashlight, now my phone is representing the number 1. And if could I use your phone for just a second? Don't need to unlock it. If I go ahead and now represent the number 1, if I want to count up as high as the number 2, where am I standing? OK, so if I want to represent the number 2, which phone needs to change? Yeah, they really need to switch so I can cheat here. But really, I should just go turn this one off and turn Jiao's on. And now if I want to represent 3, I have to turn this one back on. But if I want to represent 4 now, I need another phone. So I need another physical resource. Thank you. And so at this point, we could grab another phone, but we can just transition at this point to talking about transistors, right? You might have heard of transistors. And it turns out they're just these tiny little switches on the order of millions or billions inside of our computers today. And those switches, like the switch on the wall, just toggle things on and off. And using these patterns, whether it's 1 bit or 1 phone or 3 bits or more conventionally 8 bits or 8 transistors, can we count even higher than this? And so we try to make the point to students early on that the system that they take for granted, decimal, can actually be used in many different ways. I heard someone mention hexadecimal with our little encoding scheme on the name tags earlier. More on that later. But it's familiar to them, hopefully, more so than they might have realized. So just a little bit of a reinforcement opportunity. Would someone like to propose how, in binary, we would represent the number 50? What pattern of bits do we need to represent the number 50? And I'll give you as many as an 8's place, a 16's place, a 32's place, a 64's place, and poor planning, a 128's place. Not necessarily to scale. Amer?
Yes. We put
1
at the 32. Okay. Bit, and then we have 18. So. You want? 1 at 16.
1 at 16.
And 0, 0.
0, 0.
1.
one, and zero. Yeah. And so it sounds like Amer was doing, Amer, am I pronouncing it right? A greedy algorithm, which is actually a topic unto itself later in our typical semester. Greedy in the sense that if the problem to be solved is inputted as 50, a greedy algorithm would have a student try to take as big of a bite out of that problem as possible. So as Amer did, you know, it might have been in his mind trying to take 128 bite out of the problem, and of course that's too big. 64 is still too big, but 32 is actually reasonable because that doesn't overstep our bounds. It takes 32 out of the 50 byte. If we then try to take a 16, that's still okay because now we've taken a 32 plus 16, which is 48, so we're still good. This would be too much, this would be too much, but this is just the right size byte. And we can use this to begin to introduce students potentially to a whole discussion, a rabbit hole of sorts, of algorithms themselves. Yeah? Thank you. I represent the one right now. Okay. For as long as that would last. Thank you. So representing numbers very quickly gets tedious, and I also think it runs the risk of sort of misleading students into thinking that computer science is only about math, which itself can be a fear factor for some students. So let's quickly abstract away from this, because now that we just have a very low-level way of representing information, we've got electricity from the wall, we've got zeros and ones more digitally or more textually, if you will. How do we represent things like emails and text messages and web pages and the like? Well, we humans some years ago just came up with an arbitrary but globally consistent mapping, such that if we ever want to spell the letter A, we represent a number in decimal that happens to be 65. And what the computer really does is it doesn't store 65 per se. It stores some number of bits, maybe 8 of them, that if you turn the right ones and zeros on, represents the number 65. And so if you do get an SMS or an iMessage or whatnot on your phone, and someone has sent you the letter A, what you've really received is some pattern of bits, maybe 8 of them, that represent the decimal number 65. But we're abstracting away because I don't care how the computer stores this anymore. I just know that it can conceptually, and I know it can physically, so we can begin to abstract on top of that. So for instance, if A is 65, B is 66, H is 72, I is 73, and so forth, if you received a text message and the computer showed you, or the phone showed you, this pattern of bits, or really the decimal number 72, 73, and 33, what text message have you just received? Hi, but that's, what's the third? Yeah, it's an exclamation point. And you wouldn't know this unless you guessed or saw a chart or just remember it from some point. But indeed, 33 represents exclamation point, whereas 72 and 73, of course, represent H and I per the previous slide. So we often use this as an opportunity to even have student volunteers come down. We have them all stand along a straight line, like 8 student volunteers. We might have them raise their hand if they want to represent a 1, or stand there like this if they want to represent a 0. We can therefore spell something out in binary, put a little cheat sheet on the board that maps the code, the A's, B's, and C's to those numbers, and actually let students spell things out. So for instance, one year we did this, and I told the students with a little cheat sheet whether or not to raise their hand for each of the letters they were spelling. And the go-to bit that we use is to spell out B, O, W, which one student mistakenly decreed was bow one year, but it was meant to be a bow at the end of the demonstration, which is a more effective way to present it. So a fun sort of way you can reinforce this more visually for students and connect those zeros and ones to something more physical. But of course, the world has more than just text messages and emails. We have Photoshop and photos and videos and the like. So it turns out that computers can use this same underlying representation of information, but just use it in a different way to represent more pictorial things. So you might know the acronym RGB, red, green, blue. Red, green, blue is just a standard way that many computers and programs use to store colors. And they use 8 bits, 8 zeros and ones, to store how much red should be in a dot on the screen. They use another 8 bits to represent green and another 8 bits to represent blue, or 24 bits total. This is AKA 24-bit color, or millions of colors. And if you overlap those 3 colors, you can pretty much form any color of the rainbow for every single dot or pixel on the computer screen. So it turns out if we have this same pattern of bits, 72, 73, and 33, but in the context of Photoshop or a photograph program or something that's graphical in nature, that same pattern of bits, we point out to students, can actually represent a color. It's not a particularly attractive color in this case, but if you interpret hi, not textually, but graphically, you'll get this sort of murky shade of yellow. And that's all that's happening there. Well, this is just one dot or pixel. What is an image or a photograph? It's just a composition, a grid of like thousands or millions of dots or pixels left to right, top to bottom. So there is an image. What's a video, would you say? Yeah, a whole bunch of those, like 24 of those or 30 of those per second flying across the screen. And so we've now abstracted further from electricity to zeros and ones to now colors of the rainbow to what an image is to what a video file is. And frankly, we do all of this in the very first hour or so of our first class to very quickly reveal to students what's been going on underneath the hood, so to speak, all this time, but very quickly help them appreciate, seeing the forest through the trees, what you can really do once you understand and have this low-level foundation. And at no point have we even begun to discuss programming with them at this point. It really is about representing inputs and outputs. So this black box, though, that I mentioned, come on in, make yourselves comfortable. This black box that I mentioned is really where the intellectual juiciness is of computer science. It's how do you take inputs and produce outputs from them? How do you solve problems? And thus are provided algorithms, for instance. So an algorithm that we often do here is to do something that's fairly mundane, but can be done in different ways. For instance, if I'm ready to take like attendance now, I might do it old school and do like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And I could keep going. It's not going to take a huge amount of time, but it's a little tedious. So I remember from grade school, I could do 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, and I'm already going faster. But I dare say I could do this even faster. To do so, I'd like to invite 8 volunteers to help out, if you're comfy appearing on camera and turn the internet. But there's a free pen in it for you. OK, so Hector, we have a free pen for you. And 7 colleagues, if we could get. OK, come on up. Oh, so OK. Oh, I don't think I have 8 or 9 pens, but here, let me see. OK. One more. We have one more pen. OK. We'll find a spare pen. All right. Come on, Amer. And if you could just crunch in so that you're all here together. Let's do some quick introductions. Amer, we've met. Nice to meet you.
Likewise.
And your name?
Jose.
Jose, nice to see you.
Angela.
Austin, nice to see you. Ja. Hector. Felix.
And TJ.
TJ, nice to meet you. So each of these volunteers has a pen, but the catch is I need you, most of you, to give them away now. So here's a thing to consider. Before, the sort of fundamental limitation for me was that I could only count one person at a time or 2 persons at a time. But what if we parallelize this algorithm and have multiple CPUs, right? If a CPU is like the brains of a computer and I'm just one computer with one brain, now I have access to like 8 brains who could all be doing something in parallel. And if we consider that if a pen gets given from one person to another, I claim there's a property here of conservation of pens. We're not going to lose any of these pens. So each of those pens really represents a person. So if I could just ask maybe the half of you here, could you just give your pen away to the half of people over here? And the 4 of you who just gave your pen away, if I'm sorry, you could go sit down. Notice I've just taken a 4-person byte out of the problem, which is already bigger than my 1-person byte or my 2 persons at a time byte as before. Let's repeat this algorithm. If you two could give your pens away. Thank you. And sit down. And now Felix and TJ have all of our pens. If Felix, you could give your pens away and sit down. TJ, how many pens and therefore volunteers did we just count?
8.
And how quickly did we do that? Well, in my first algorithm, it was 1, 2, 3, 4. So if there's like 50 people in the room, it's 50 steps. If I do it 2, 4, 6, 8, and there's 50 people in the room, it's like 25 steps. But if we take TJ's approach here, he counted 8 people, not in 8 steps, not even in 4 steps, but in
2 steps.
That's pretty good, but 3 steps, really, because we gave them away 3 total times, I think, until TJ was left standing. So now, maybe a round of applause for TJ, who now has 8 pens. We actually have pens for everyone, so let me send, if you'd like to give those back to everyone. We have pens for everyone. But this is hopefully an attempt, then.
I'll leave them
here. OK. This is an opportunity to really get students thinking about efficiency. Now, that wasn't too crazy of an algorithm. And in fact, that principle, that dividing and conquering a big problem into a smaller problem, into an even smaller problem, by just repeating the same fundamental process, is pretty omnipresent. Right? Even on our phones, most of us have some kind of contacts or address book. And odds are it's listed alphabetically by first name or last name. And most of us realistically don't really think about this all that often. But if you start to do autocomplete to find a family or friend, family member or friend, what's the phone doing underneath the hood? It might be just looking at the top and going all the way to the bottom looking for that person A through Z. Or maybe it's doing it 2 at a time, but that would be wrong. But what would you do in the physical world, right? It wasn't all that long ago that most of us used devices like these, right? The proverbial phone book, which is really just the same thing as that, except rather than a digital list top to bottom, it's a physical list from left to right, but it's still alphabetized. So what's the analog? If I want to look for a friend of mine, I always call him Mike Smith, I might start at the beginning, look at page one, look at page two, look at page three, looking for Mike Smith, and if and when I find him, I call him. Is that algorithm, that step-by-step page turning, correct? Sorry?
Sequential search.
Sequential search, sure, call it that. Is it correct? That algorithm. Yeah, it is. It's slow. It's a little inefficient, surely. But it is correct, because if Mike is in here, even if he's all the way at the end for whatever reason, I will find him. But let me take a lesson from grade school. If I now do 2, 4, 6, 8, is this algorithm correct? Assuming I can actually physically do it correctly. Is this algorithm correct?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. What's the gotcha?
Yeah,
there's this corner case, if you will, whereby I might just accidentally or unfortunately sandwich Mike between two pages based on where he falls and then blow right, oops, okay, that's a second bug in the algorithm. I might just blow past Mike in the phone book, so I could correct this. Like, what's a heuristic, a trick I could use to fix this bug without throwing out the speed gains?
Check to see if you've gone too far and then go back one.
Exactly. So roughly speaking, if I hit the T section, I should probably double back at least one page to make sure I didn't miss Mike along the way. So you still get significant speed benefits because you can fly through the phone book twice as fast except for like the last page or two. But of course, none of us, if we ever use this technology, do that. Most of us probably go roughly to the middle. And you look down, and what decision are you making as a human with this device? Yeah, is it less than or greater than is the person I'm looking for less than or greater than what you claim M, which is, yeah, indeed, roughly the middle of the phone book. And Smith, of course, S, is going to be on this half of the phone book only. But what's compelling is now I've flown through, like, I don't know, 500 pages. If this is 1,000 pages, I've just crossed off the list 500 candidate pages all in one fell swoop. And so what do I know about Mike Smith, to be clear? Where is he? If he's here at all, he's in this half, and dramatically in class, can we both figuratively and literally tear the problem in half, throw half of it away, being left with fundamentally the same problem, of course, but now it's a 500-page problem, not a 1,000-page problem. Similarly, when we had our volunteers, we went to an 8-person problem to a 4-person problem, all in one fell swoop, a la divide and conquer, or more formally, we might now call this, if familiar, binary search. By meaning two, we're splitting it in half again and again. And we repeat. I go roughly to the middle of this problem. I see I'm in the T section. So what do I know? Well, Mike is surely not in this half of the remaining phone book. That's another 250 bytes out all at once. And I can repeat, repeat, repeat until I'm hopefully left algorithmically with just one final page. There's only one problem with this algorithm. In practice, it's really hard to find phone books, and I always die a little bit every time we do this. But it's a wonderful visual, we think, and I think connecting it all the more to what's going on in the physical device helps students realize that, yeah, that probably is what my phone is doing. Maybe it's lazily going top to bottom, but maybe it could be smarter and go roughly to the M's, then go to the T's, then double back a little to the S's, really taking these bigger and bigger bites out of the problem fundamentally. Not unlike Google and the Facebooks and Instagrams and all of these popular tools must surely be doing when you're searching not hundreds of friends and family members, but millions of other people on that platform. So let's it's not just me talking and moving around. Let's try one other example that we occasionally use in our own semester that gets everyone in the room involved. Because of course, if I want to take attendance, which I still haven't finished doing, it'd be nice if I could leverage all of us. And we don't quite have pens out yet. But let me just propose that everyone think of the number one. So just as we physically had the one pen, if everyone could think of virtually now having the number one. And if you wouldn't mind just humoring us and just stand up in place all together. That's step zero. Of course, computer scientists or programmers tend to start counting at zero because that's the fewest number of fingers you can hold up, so to speak. So step one is about to be this. I would like to propose that everyone in this room pair off with someone standing and then add your numbers together. Okay. All right. And then step two, just like our pen example, half of you sit down. Just one person in the pair sit down. And then if you could, if you're still standing, go back to step one and repeat. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So we keep going with the algorithm. The algorithm again has us repeating. Here's the algorithm again. So if you're still standing, be sure to pair off with someone. All right. Okay, we got to get Mohammed a partner. Okay, hang on there. All right, almost paired off. Okay, I'm gonna help. Let me help. We'll get us to the finish line. So if you're still standing, normally you would hand off your number verbally. I'll just jot it all down. So what number are you still thinking of?
Eight.
Okay, that's fine. Now you can sit down. I'll take over your number. And what number are you thinking of?
Nine.
Okay. And over here, Mohammed?
18.
Okay, go ahead and sit down. And over here?
Eight.
Okay, and your number?
And six.
And six. And is anyone else still standing? All right, so when I hit enter, this will add up the remaining numbers just as if they had bubbled up to one last person. And that gives us 49. Is that actually correct?
They didn't count you. Yeah, it's correct.
Then, and that is perfectly correct execution. Which, honestly, that might be unprecedented. Because this is a wonderful opportunity to now talk about a bug and what happens. And we often have to help with the arithmetic at the end, because it's on scale especially. But that was amazing. So bug-free day for sure. So what do we now do? We try to get students thinking about, just somewhat abstractly, but in a useful way, like how much better is that algorithm? To be fair, both Doug and I counted, I think, faster than that algorithm did. But if we had 49, 50 people, that was like take 25 of you, give or take, sat down, then 12 and a half of you sat down. And so we took pretty big bites, whereas Doug and I, counting old school, were doing it at best 1, 2, 3, 4, or 2, 4, 6, 8, taking one or two bites at a time, not 25, not 12, or 12 and a half, and so forth. So your algorithm, despite the sort of social friction of making that work quickly, is fundamentally better, fundamentally faster, if you will, and indeed fundamentally correct. So how do we think about that? Well, if we very abstractly and not without getting into the weeds of mathematics and arithmetic here, we can just generalize. So if I want to show the class the relationship between the size of a problem, the number of inputs, and the time to solve it to produce some output, I'm just going to draw a horizontal and a vertical axis like this. And I claim that the first algorithm, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it's just a straight line. And why is it a straight line? Doesn't really matter what the axes are, what the numbers are, but the relationship is a straight slope. Because if one more person comes into the room, it's going to take us one more step, one more second, one more unit of time. And so it's a linear relationship, if you will. And n generally refers to the number of inputs, number of people in the room. The second algorithm, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, sounds faster, is faster, it's twice as fast, but it's the same shape. Because if two people come into the room, it's still going to take me one more second or unit of time. If four people come in the room, it's going to take me two units of time. So it's a linear relationship, albeit a little lower on the graph. And if I could reach, I could point out that if the size of the problem is here, you'll notice that the red line takes more time than the yellow line. And that makes sense intuitively, because if you're counting by twos versus by ones. But the third algorithm, where fundamentally half of you were sitting down, then half of you, and even though the halves were getting smaller, they were still fundamentally bigger than constant size bytes like one or two, that shape is completely different. And this is a shape that's a little harder for students to necessarily appreciate unless we explain it in our case by example. What if the number of people in the room suddenly doubled? Like we had to cram another 49 people in here and they all came in at once. It's going to feel packed. It's going to be twice as big an audience. But how many more steps would it take to count those additional people? just one, right? Because those folks could just sit down all at once, or we could all sit down at once and let them finish the algorithm. And so that's a powerful idea, and divide and conquer is a nice casual way of describing it, but it's a principle with which most students are probably intuitively familiar, and so we point out that computer science, and eventually programming thereof, is going to be all about kind of harnessing that intuition and learning new mental tricks and techniques for solving problems, not just correctly, but efficiently. So how do we begin to formalize problem solving with students? We don't get into the weeds of code even just yet, but we point out pseudocode, English-like syntax that there's no one rule or format for. You just kind of express yourself succinctly in English or whatever your native language is. And so I might propose that the algorithm with which I searched for Mike Smith just now was this. Step zero, I picked up the phone book, sort of an action or a verb. Step one, open to the middle of the phone book. And so I split the phone book in half, and that too was a verb or an action. I looked at the names, as by skimming who's on the page. I then checked. If Smith is among the names, what did I do? Or what would I have done if I got lucky? Stop, right? Probably call Mike because he's right there among the names. But that might not happen. And so I might only call him conditionally. And I point out to students, you know what, line four, let's only do line four if line three is true. So I'm just conveying some meaning by my indentation. But if I ask myself the other question, what if Mike is earlier in the book to the left? What do I want to do with that algorithm? If I split to the middle and I know Mike is to the left. Go back to the beginning, not quite the beginning, to the the middle of the left-hand side. If I've got these two halves, two 500 sets of pages on my left hand and right hand, I don't want to go necessarily all the way back to the beginning because that would kind of undo that work, but to the half of that left-hand side. And so I could express this open to the middle of the left half of the book. And I do it generally by eye, but you could do it certainly more formally. And then go back to step two. Because once I've whittled the problem down to the left half of the phone book, the algorithm is still the same. I'm just so much closer to finding Mike or not at all. Else, if Mike is later in the book, go ahead and do the same thing with the middle of the right half of the book, and then also go back to step two. And here's an opportunity to point out to students, you know, there's not just three cases. There's a fourth case here where if we fail to handle it, we're going to deduce the equivalent of the spinning beach ball or the hourglass or your Mac or PC is going to freeze. Because at the end of the day, that's often what a bug is. A human programmer has not anticipated some scenario. And what might the 11th step or fourth scenario here be? There is no Mike Smith, and I better handle that so that I explicitly quit or something so that my program, if this were actually implemented in a robot or a machine, doesn't just do something unpredictable altogether. And so this is how we might point out to students, now we take this intuition, we apply it to a new problem, searching in a phone book here, and now we can formalize it, but each of us could have written this in a dozen different ways in many different languages, but let's pull out the salient characteristics. In yellow here, I'd argue are what we're going to start calling functions, because now we want to begin pretty early on in the semester transitioning from ideas to practice and implementation thereof. So these yellow keywords are going to be our verbs, our actions, or we're going to call them functions or procedures moving forward. If I look at some other fundamental constructs or keywords here, if, else, if, else, if, else, these I'm going to call conditions or branches, the proverbial fork in the road where you're either going to go this way, or some other way. And how do you decide which road to go down? Well, you ask yourself a question, the answer to which is either yes or no, or true or false, or one or zero, however you want to think about the world. And these we're going to call Boolean expressions, after an actual mathematician named Boole. But that's just a component now to these branches or conditions. And then lastly, and you don't see these implemented in quite the same way in modern languages, but this is very intuitive here, highlighted in yellow now is another type of action, but it's cyclical. So we're going to call these loops or cycles, do something again and again. And so pretty quickly have we taken a familiar human process, slapped some jargon or vocabulary on it, but in a way that hopefully resonates with students, like, okay, I got it. I might not have heard of function before in this context, or Boolean expressions certainly, but okay, I get it. There's four fundamental building blocks here. And in CS50, what we do is then transition to Scratch, with which you might be familiar, this graphical language from MIT's Media Lab, where you can actually explore these exact same ideas in a very fun, graphical, acoustic way way by dragging and dropping puzzle pieces. And indeed, the very first program we have students write is just Hello World by dragging and dropping these two puzzle pieces. And we'll defer to another time or to your own experience what more you can do with Scratch. But allow me to transition now just to give a rapid fire overview, especially for those less familiar, of what the arc really is of the curriculum and where the junctures are where you can kind of go down the rabbit hole or not, or focus really on what your students want to learn or what they might not understand well by giving this overview here. So within the context of Scratch, do we explore all of these ideas and a few more? And in fact, what's fun about Scratch is that you can explore pretty early on some fairly sophisticated topics, even threading and event handling, if familiar, that we'll actually see again later in the semester when we return to web programming and consider how web servers and web applications can similarly seemingly do multiple things at once and respond to human events. So we kind of come full circle in that way. In terms of CS50 itself, allow me to offer a few definitions, because CS50 is rather an umbrella term that refers to a number of our initiatives here on and off campus. So CS50 proper, the original term, is just the undergraduate introduction to computer science here at Harvard for majors and non-majors. Happens to be the largest class these days at Harvard with about 700 undergrads. It's also offered down the road in New Haven at Yale University, where we have about 150 undergrads. And we also have 300 or so students through Harvard's Extension Score continuing ed program here in Cambridge and really around the world. The course, as you know, it also exists as a so-called MOOC, Massive Open Online Course, whereby it's freely available on edX.org. In that audience, we've had over the past several years over 1 million or so registrants, not all of whom finished certainly, but who've engaged in some way, and localized communities here in the US, Kansas City, Miami, Rhode Island, St. Louis, and elsewhere, and then internationally in Bolivia, Burma, Chile, Netherlands, Nicaragua, the UK, Ukraine, and beyond. And this is to say that more than just a MOOC, sort of freely available curricular materials that anyone can just take, we've really focused in the past few years, thanks to Greg and Aaron and Doug and rest of CS50's team, really on building these localized support communities, both organically in some of these towns and also more systematically by engaging with teachers in addition to students alone. And so that indeed is what CS50 AP has been all about, an adaptation of the course's curriculum from a college level to really a 32 or 36 week high school schedule. Same curriculum, same technology, same expectations, albeit tailored by individual teachers to his or her own students. And as of late, we have about 150 teachers or high schools adopting or adapting the course in some form with about 5,000 or so students over the past few years. And then lastly is there CS50 for MBAs, which is a different course. Its curriculum too is freely available, but that takes more of a business-minded approach. Students younger and older who are just curious about making better decisions informed by technology, holding their own more in conversations with engineering type folks. And that curriculum is offered across the river here officially at Harvard's Business School. And to paint a picture of all of these communities, this is a graph that Aaron and Greg have put together where every red dot represents a high school that's been working with us or the curriculum in some form, and every blue dot represents a university. As for what the course looks like here on campus, this is where we begin every semester when students shop or drop in on the course. The course for our own undergrads is available online, both live streamed and also on demand. So this very impressive attendance very quickly achieves a lower equilibrium, because even among many of our own students, do many of them watch online or rewatch online. So their experience here in Cambridge is almost functionally equivalent to that in New Haven or even any high schools or universities who are having their students watch some or all of our materials. Again, curricularly and technologically, everyone has access to the same resources. This proudly was one of our first cohorts of teachers a few years ago now who came to that same space, Sanders Theater, to then go back to their own local communities to teach. This was one of our workshops just like today in Washington, D.C., I believe this one was. Here was in the UK. Here was again in Cambridge in a different space. And then very excitingly a few years ago did we have our first ever CS50 AP hackathon, which brought together four public and for private high schools in the Manhattan area to a local school to work on their final projects, work on their homework assignments, all alongside each other and their teachers. Here are some of our students in Miami-Dade College proudly exhibiting their certificates, one of whose recipients is back there manning the camera now, Arturo. Here are some of our students from Chile. Here are some of our students in University College London. Here we have some of our students led by a student volunteer there in Burma. This is Bolivia. And most recently, for some of our online puzzle day initiatives, more on that later today, some of our students in Pakistan, in Egypt, in Ukraine, in India, in Congo, and in Nicaragua. So these are just a few of the glimpses, but really of the communities that we've focused on. So more than just making curriculum available and more than just focusing on computer science alone, have we really focused on doing what we can and everything we can to provide support and assistance and ideas and community for teachers and students alike. And a key point to make perhaps too is that even though this course originates here at Harvard University and Yale universities, also down the road, it is by design for students who have and have not ever taken a computer science course before. And here in Cambridge alone, do 68% of our students every fall semester among the undergrads never have taken a CS course before. And so they too are among those going from 0 to 60 over the course of just a few months. Here's how they describe themselves. 61% of those students last year described themselves as less comfortable. 10% of them described themselves as more comfortable, and the others somewhere in between. These have no formal definitions. You just kind of know you're less comfortable if you're a little ill at ease with even being in the classroom that first day and are thinking, this is not really my world, I'm not a computer person. And you're more comfortable probably if you've been programming since you were 10 years old or whatnot, or just feel you have a knack for it. But we have all three of these demographics together. And within the class here at Harvard and Yale and elsewhere, do we have different tracks for students, different sections or recitations? So in addition to the lectures that you glimpsed a photo of before, typically led by me, do we have a whole team of teaching fellows here and elsewhere or teaching assistants, often who are undergraduates themselves or increasingly perhaps high school students as well who have taken the course or just have greater comfort, who are guiding their classmates through the curriculum? And even within the homework assignments, do we have less comfy and more comfy problems, which credit-wise are equivalent, but we encourage students maybe at the beginning of the semester, you know, stick in the comfort zone of the less comfortable problems, and then mid-semester start doing some of the more comfy, and by the end of the semester try doing most of the more comfy problems. And they generally cover the same material, but assume a little bit more certainly comfort, but also just sophistication, or they provide a little less hand-holding to hopefully take by semester's end or year's end some of those training wheels off. And in terms of assessment, and we'll go into more of this more mechanically over the course of the weekend, but we really do say and mean this. What ultimately matters in this course for students is not so much where you end up relative to your classmates, but where you in week 11, which in our case is the end of the semester, end up relative to yourself in week zero, zero indexed, of course. And we truly do look at that delta, even though we have many data points that are collected by students' homework assignments and exams over the course of the year. It's very much an individualized conversation between me and the course's staff, teaching fellows in our case, so that we're really looking at that delta, not some absolute measure of student success. And thanks to our first couple of years of teachers have the students themselves been doing wonderfully impressive. This is just a quick chart, and there's more detail online. This is data from the College Board, for instance, where blue represents AP computer science principals, students around the world. Red happens to represent CS50's subset demographic, but we're very pleased and relieved to say that our students have done wonderfully even in the first official offering of the AP CSP exam. Red meaning here the highest quartile, did more of them perform toward that end. And we're waiting to see what this year's data looks like, because just the second administration of it happened as well. And that's entirely thanks to the network of teachers who worked that magic. So what is the curriculum itself? To give you an oversimplified view, we start, of course, the semester with Scratch, but we very quickly transition to C, exploring algorithms a little more methodically, a little more code-oriented, but also some lower-level topics like memory. And indeed, we use C for much of the semester so that students really do understand from the ground floor up what's going on inside of a computer, and so that there really is no magic. If something's happening inside that computer, it's because you moved a value from here to here, or you asked the computer for memory and you did something with it. Later in the semester, do we transition to more modern web programming in a context that kids are more familiar with? But we do this in the context of Python and SQL and JavaScript, which are higher level languages that we dare say students understand so much more readily, because they understand when you have a dictionary or dict in Python exactly what it must be doing for you in that split second, because someone else has thought to implement a hash table or some other kind of tree structure underneath the hood. In terms of the course's problem sets or homework assignments, do we begin the semester two with Scratch, where it's very open-ended, pretty much build most anything of interest to you using a few dozen puzzle pieces? And then this past year, did we have such problems as these, all of which are available for our AP audience and for our university audiences? One in which we explored the world of cryptography. Students had to write code to encrypt or decrypt information using either a less comfy cipher or a more comfortable one as well. We introduced for the very first time music this year. One of our teaching fellows, Brian, wrote the draft of a problem set that allowed students to first learn how to read sheet music. We thought this would be a nice side effect of taking a computer science course, really hammer home the point of CS's intersection with other fields, especially the arts. And so we teach students in this problem to read sheet music, albeit in limited form, and then we have them write code to synthesize music from sheet music. So you feed in some textual representation of the notes, A through G, or flat and sharp, and then you actually generate a sound file that if you double click or run a command, you can hear it from your own Mac or PC. Every semester, we introduce students to the world of digital forensics in sort of a very real, not so much CSI type approach, if familiar with the show, where we give students a forensic image of a digital camera whose photographs have been deleted or corrupted in some way, and we have them write code to recover all of the JPEGs from that digital camera, because it turns out that JPEGs have this nice property that the first four bytes are specific values. And so just with high probability, if you're looking over millions and millions of zeros and ones, but you see the same pattern of 32 bits here, 32 bits here, 32 bits here, odds are that demarcates the start of a JPEG. And so you can slice out those zeros and ones and reconstitute what were the deleted photos. Misspellings here, we introduce students to higher level data structures. We have give them a text file with like 150,000 words, and we have them build software that actually spell checks files as quickly and as efficiently as they can using as little memory and time as possible. The year ago, we introduced students to sentiment analysis. And again, let me pause to emphasize, 68% of the students doing these problems last year and in years past had no prior experience before this whirlwind tour as well. In sentiment analysis, do we feed students another couple of lists of positive sounding words and negative sounding words, happy being positive, sad being negative, that sort of taxonomy. And we had them analyze tweets that were coming in live and actually analyze whether this was a positive sounding tweet, a negative sounding tweet, or something neutral in between. CS50 Finance, we have students hook into an API, application programming interface, just getting nearly real-time stock quotes, and have them implement an eTrade.com-like website where they can buy and sell stocks virtually. And then lastly, Mashup, where they take Google News and Google Maps, mash them together, so to speak, and create a nice interactive clickable map where you can click on any town or zip code and actually see 10 or so articles from a new local news source. And then punctuating the semester are these events to which I alluded earlier, Puzzle Day, a coding contest in years past, the hackathon and fair. Here is just a glimpse of what a puzzle day might look like here on campus. Students are welcome to use their laptops, but there's no programming or expectation thereof. Rather, students are just encouraged to collaborate with peers. This was one of our very first CS50 hackathons, which we happen to run from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m., though we've also done it during daytime hours with younger audiences, because typically around 4 a.m. do you see such images as these. Not staged. Here is one of our CS50 fairs. And the key detail here is that it's not just for the students in the class, but it's for all of their classmates, younger and older, and faculty and students elsewhere on campus to come and delight in what the students have themselves accomplished. Again, having never touched a computer science course before this, and so quite gratifying are such glimpses as these, because the whole purpose of the CS50 fair is really just for students to gather and show off what they've done in the spirit of a science fair itself, that being one of my favorite photos from yesteryear. And so in retrospect, I think, have we tried to distill and think about what it is we do and why it is we do it? And I think there's these three sort of guiding lights that we've since had. From the get-go of my taking over the class some 11 years ago, was accessibility the number one goal, at least for me mentally. Not making the course easier or lowering expectations, but rather changing the slope of the course's on-ramp so that rather than start with something like assembly language, or rather than to start with an assumption that surely some of you have programmed before, we don't assume any of that. We do offer different tracks for students who do select into these different backgrounds and contexts, but the goal was to ensure that any student, irrespective of his or her prior background or lack thereof, could succeed. And really putting in place the requisite support structure to ensure that students could succeed. What that means here on campus is nowadays we have some 80 undergraduate teaching fellows and course assistants, so roughly a 1-to-10 ratio. We've encouraged teachers at the high school level to deputize, so to speak, some of their current or former students as well, because I dare say our TFs, and myself included, learn material no better than when you're actually teaching it, as opposed to only being the student in the classroom. And indeed, what we try to do is create along the way this community, as via some of these events, as via things like the CS50 Pen, so that hopefully students at any age level feel that they're part of something a little special, certainly this shared collective experience, and not just one of their usual 7 or 32 or however many courses they're taking over the course of a year or a university. But rigor has been important too. Rigor meaning that we've not sort of lowered our expectations of students. Here at Harvard even, it's among the highest workload courses, and certainly within APCS principles, if you're familiar with the framework, we're absolutely a superset of what's expected in that curriculum, more software focused than some of the alternatives. But this is very much by design and intent, because our hope is that by holding students to this level of expectation, providing them, though, with the requisite support, and wonderfully at the high school level with some 32, sometimes 36 weeks, as opposed to our more limited 12 weeks here at the college. I mean, time has generally been the key secret ingredient, and time and human support to ensure that all students at the end of the semester or year can literally receive, and we can help you procure these, I Took CS50 t-shirts, which say quite simply and quite factually that, hopefully with some sense of pride at year's end. So that then is the very high level overview of what CS50 is in all of its several forms. There's even more than that, and we'll explore that over the course of today. Here's just a quick glimpse of the schedule for this afternoon, and we'll do the same over an email tonight about tomorrow and Sunday. But let me pause here to see, before we take a break, if there are any questions.